From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. The comedian and talk show host Chelsea Handler catapulted to fame and fortune based in part on stand-up routines incorporating a lacerating style, her verbal darts directed at her own choices and at those of others. Unusually for a woman in Hollywood, Handler is someone who says, take me on my terms. A modern-day Joan Rivers, pushing boundaries and pushing buttons and often pushing people away. That turned out to be a problem, even for her. After introspection, a reckoning with loss and self, the insult comic has emerged with more empathy, which she explores in a new book and a podcast series. This hour On Point, Chelsea Handler on humanity, humility, and comedy. Join us. What struck you about Chelsea Handler's stand-up and talk shows? How do you feel about her very public evolution and her pursuit of self-awareness? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on the Twitters and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us from NPR West in Culver City, California, Chelsea Handler. She has a new podcast called Life Will Be the Death of Me. It's adapted from her best-selling memoir of the same name. I think, if I'm not mistaken, it debuted at number one on the New York Times bestseller list. Both the podcast and the book reflect the insights of a journey of self-discovery that last a year and that she says will last a lifetime. Chelsea Handler, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me, David. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you this way. So you're, if I'm not mistaken, sixth book, and you've had, I think, five or six previous bestsellers?
Yes, yes. This is my sixth book.
That's
I would say this would... I would say, I would argue this is my first memoir, but they were all sort of memoirish. This would probably be the first deep dive, psychologically speaking.
Well, and you offer a lot of insights there. Before we get to that, and before we get to some of the insights and some of the revelations, which aren't just revelations to your fans and your readers, but came as something of revelations to yourself, I want to talk a little bit about your comedy. And first, I want to play a couple of clips for listeners to remind them a little bit of what you are and to introduce some of our listeners who may not be as aware of what you've done over the years. So let's take Chelsea Lately. It was a hit nightly talk show for the E! Network, I think, from 2007 to 2014. And here's a montage of a few of many colorful moments from that program.
I want to know what you drink to keep your body like that, because what I'm drinking is not working. Everyone I know has done the walk of shame at some point. People do it every day after I interview them on this show.
When I said I was 76, I wanted you to say you don't look as old as 76, and you never said that.
Well, because I do think you look about 76.
Chelsea Handler, my sense is that your humor is driven by two things, but I'd rather have you articulate it. My sense in watching you over the years is that you're driven by a sense of at times real anger or intensity, and also by a sense that you are going to say what is on your mind and you are not really going to filter it. Where does your comedy come from?
Yes, I would argue that it's not really, I don't even have to make the argument. I would said whatever I thought, and I got rewarded for that for a long time. So I thought that that was the way to go about life. Like, oh, wow, this is so, if it's so unusual, this is a commodity. This is something that we need more of. So I was really, really honest with everybody else about what I thought was wrong with them, and always, you know, never actually taking a look at myself, because God forbid I would do that. It was like, oh no, I'm just going to fix everybody else and I'll be the one who says what everybody's thinking. And, you know, when you get rewarded for something, you think you're doing the right thing, and you think, oh, you get a TV show. And even though that's not a measure of, you know, success on all terms, It was a measure of success in my life, and it was what mattered to me. So you get rewarded, you get book deals, and then you're doing stand-up, and you're on tour, and you're kind of glorifying drinking and partying and being this kind of loud, brash woman. And that was who I was instinctively, and it is a huge part of who I am, but it is not all of who I am. And it took me a while to get a little bit deeper and to get past that veneer and to get past that protective layer of what it means when you're constantly insulting the world and not taking a look at yourself.
So before we get to your what you call and are annoyed by calling concurrently your journey, right? Your path.
I have to come up with a new word for journey. It's like The Bachelor ruined that word so many years ago for me. So until we come up with a replacement, we'll just say journey in quotes.
Right. You know, The Bachelor has ruined so many things.
I don't know that we should limit
it to just the word journey,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
So I do want to get at the question. You talked about rewards, right? And so are you talking about being rewarded in a professional sense? Like, hey, I can get a gig. Hey, I can get a return, you know, I can get a return appointment at the Improv in Hollywood, or I can get a book deal, or I can get booked as a guest, or suddenly I can have my own show? Or were you also being rewarded in your personal life for this, that people were like, hey, this is fun? I mean, my God, the list of friends that you trot out on your show and for your podcast and in the appearances to come, these are pretty strong Hollywood friends to hang out with, right? So are you also being rewarded in that world as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, whenever you have some kind of like a different take or a fresh take on something, you know, it's not like I was the first person to insult people, but I became, I guess, I don't really know how to describe my own experience. You know what I mean? What I've learned is that we really don't have a clear, you know, awareness of ourselves. It takes a lot of work to do that. So I wouldn't want to frame it in any way that I saw it, because it's not necessarily the accurate view. But, you know, people liked it. People, you know, what I got was that people liked it. People were either really scared of me or people loved it. And that's been my whole life. People either love me or hate me. So I'm used to that. I don't really know any other way. I mean, this book is kind of the first experience I've had with having something be so well received. I've never had people being like reaching out in the way that they have been, in a nice way, like I did something good instead of just, you know, glorifying my personal lifestyle.
And all the while being pretty brutal on yourself. Why so tough on yourself, as well as being – you seem to be sort of celebrating it. It's almost as though you're holding a big wine glass aloft, and at the same time kind of making clear, hey, this is really poisonous behavior here, guys.
Yeah. I mean, I think I had to say, you know, I'm very hard on myself to begin with. And especially now, since I have much more self-awareness through my psychiatrist, Dan, and everything that I've been, you know, that I do talk about in the book, I am much harder on myself than I need to be. But I also thought that was necessary. You know, he's always like, don't judge yourself so harshly. And I'm like, I think I deserve my own judgment. I think that's what's been missing this whole time. So, you know, you can figure yourself out and not beat yourself up about it and just get better at being you. You know, it's not about fixing the past, and I wouldn't want to fix the past. That's part of who I am. And it was fun and great and wonderful and a huge learning experience. But I know how to move forward in life by being better and being more responsible and being more mindful of other people. And not just, you know, what I learned through this journey is that this isn't just about, you know, I went through life for so many years thinking about me and myself and my family and my friends and my. And until really the election is when I had to stop, and I couldn't take the pain of it and the outrage of it. And that's when I started to look outside of myself and say, wait, this isn't just about you. This is about all of us. You're sitting here. You're the problem. You're part of the problem because you're worried about yourself, 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 and your career and your career. And yes, let's do this book and this tour and this stand-up and this TV show. Instead of saying, what am I doing for, like, what is my contribution here? What am I doing for other people?
All right. So let's talk a little bit about that. But let's first introduce it by acknowledging, you know, the president before he was president and then after he was president has been a strong focus of your satire. You know, your talk show Chelsea made its debut in 2016 on Netflix, and it was the first streaming talk show program of its kind at that time. In a 2017 episode, you welcomed Chelsea Handler welcomed an actor playing President Trump's press secretary, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, to the stage.
Can you explain to me why Puerto Rico still doesn't have 70% of its power?
Listen, I'm jealous of Puerto Rico, for one, not having power. I think it's great. Sometimes you just need to unplug. I personally go home and turn the power off, you know? Kids need less screen time these days, so by the way, we just found out that President Trump is also the president of Puerto Rico, okay?
That's just a good bit, right? I mean, that's just a good clean bit. At the same time, like, he was the locus and the inspiration for just this outpouring of, it sounds like, from listening to you, from reading you, a sense of increased anger and a sense of impotence. What did that election do to you?
That election was a trigger for me. I mean, I think, and I didn't realize I couldn't, you know, now it makes sense in retrospect. Oh, yes, it represented to me, you know, I went to my psychiatrist shortly after the election because I wasn't able to manage my outrage. I was on this news tear and I was watching MSNBC or CNN, you know, or Fox News, whatever, just constantly waiting for the ball, you know, the other shoe to drop, like waiting for them to drag Trump out of the White House, you know, in his underwear, like with his toupee flying around the Rose Garden and then hopefully landing there. I was so angry and I was like, this is not going to work. Like, I'm going to give myself cancer. I was obsessed. I couldn't believe it. And I was acting like a really spoiled brat. And that's when I realized, like, wait, this is childlike what I'm doing right now. I was like stomping my feet, you know? And when I was able to finally get real with Dan, who I write about in my book, and get past complaining about Trump and their family and, you know, the fact that they all look like vampires or I don't like their veneers, when I was able to get real about what I was angry about, which was, he explained to me, Trump represents something that you can finally be identifiably angry about. Now, that was something
you, this gives you, and we'll talk after a brief break, we'll talk a little bit about what more you learned, but this gave you license to say, you know what, you're not just incoherently angry, you're raging about something specific, or at least that's what you told yourself.
Yes. Like, oh, finally I had something to be angry about. Trump. This is perfect. I could put all my anger that I've been stuffing down my throat and in my pocket for so many years on Trump. And, you know, intellectually, I didn't make the connection that what I was really angry about was, you know, what happened to me when I was a little
something
girl.
From far earlier that happened to a very young Chelsea Handler that she had to deal with as an adult. We're talking with the comedian, talk show host, and author, Chelsea Handler. We're talking about comedy, politics, her career, her childhood, and we planned to leave few stones unturned. You can join our conversations. What questions do you have for Chelsea Handler about her journey and about her comedy? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're talking with the comedic star Chelsea Handler about her life, her career, and her evolution following an intense period of introspection over politics and personal loss. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. With us from NPR West in Culver City, California, Chelsea Handler. Her new podcast, as is her new book, is called Life Will Be the Death of Me. Thanks again for being with us this hour, Chelsea.
Thank you for having me, David.
Yeah. So, to give people a sense of a little texture for what you're talking about in terms of behavior that one might, you know, empirically, reasonably as a human being call less than gracious, let's turn to a testimony from someone who adores you. That's your best friend, the actor Mary McCormick. She pops up a lot in your life. She pops up, I think it's the very first podcast episode that you put out, which I listened to this week. And here's how she characterized how Chelsea Handler used to treat people. This, again, is from the debut episode of the podcast Life Will Be the Death of Me.
She's always been inquisitive, like meeting people and stuff. But she also has if someone says something stupid or is just a little bit boring, she used to just be like, I could see her glaze over. And then I'd be like, we should go because it's going to get soon. She'll just say to their face, like, are you serious with that story? Like she would really. And then we'd have like an awkward exit where I'm going, hey, it's okay. Like behind her, she's already in the car going, Mary, you know, in the car yelling at me because I'm inside doing the apology tour. So. That I'm less on the apology tour.
That's what we should call my book tour, the apology tour.
Great idea.
I got to say, Chelsea, that really would have been a good idea. The Chelsea Handler apology tour.
Well, I just added more stand up dates, so maybe I'll just change it and call it the apology tour because that's basically what it's become.
Well, so like Mary in that episode, you know, basically says, you know, let me give you an example. And she talks about this woman. We'll be a little gentle in how we explain it, but the word wasn't quite so gentle. She says, you know, she ran into Chelsea, sees this woman at this party, and they've known each other since, I don't know what it was, like high school. And basically she says something like, nice dress. And the woman says, oh, you like it? And you say, yes, it looks like. And you basically says, it looks like something a prostitute would wear. And you walk off. And then Mary's like, so I'm explaining to her that she's just trying to be funny and that she knows that it's a cartoon thing and we all know it's funny, but it's not that, you know, there's this sort of elaborate deconstruction in the, you know, the woman droops, right?
Yeah.
Why did you – this was not a scene in which you're going to get a gig for it, right? Like you're not going to get a book contract for doing it. This is not something you're going to get professionally rewarded for you. So why did you feel at that time that you had license to do that to somebody who just, you know, wasn't – you weren't feeling their worth at that moment?
It's my sense of humor. You know, it was my way of being funny without thinking about how the person's receiving it, just thinking about making my joke. You know, I was thinking about myself again, thinking about, oh, this is a funny thing to say right here, not thinking, oh, that might hurt someone's feelings, you know, which is obviously embarrassing for a 40-year-old woman to admit. I'm 44 right now, but for, when that happened, I'm sure, whatever, it's... It wasn't – I was constantly presenting myself instead of listening, inserting instead of sitting back. I didn't have the ability or the skill set. I have the ability. I just wasn't tapping into it to talk less and stop inserting yourself and to actually think about how things are being received rather than how you're coming across. It was very selfish, self-absorbed behavior, very presentational. I am what I am. Nobody can change me. I'm tough. If you don't like it, don't talk to me. That.
You've embarked as a result of the Trump thing, you embarked on this introspection. And before we get to something that turned out to be the root of this, you know, it started to affect your thinking about these very issues. So your assistant is Brandon Marlowe. And can we just stop there? Your assistant's named Brandon Marlowe?
Is this a stage name for a personal assistant? No, it's real. Can you believe it? Brandon Marlowe. Everyone's like, wait, is this a joke? I'm like, no, it's perfect.
So, Brandon, I want to say first off, my last name's Folkenflick.
He's listening,
Brandon. I'm not making fun of anybody's names, but can you either vouch for or ask Brandon, were his parents aware of this?
Yes, I'm pretty sure that they know who Marlon Brando is. So I'm pretty sure it was probably intentional. But I can confirm or deny that after this interview is over.
Well, Brandon, I salute you, named on a bet nonetheless. So Brandon often appears on the episodes of Life Will Be the Death of Me, right? And here he's kind of reflective on what your year of introspection has yielded.
I think that you have become more independent, less dependent on me in a lot of ways. But for me, it was always like I would tell you, and I think sometimes I would tell you in times where you were already frustrated, so it was hard to hear. But there's a difference in wanting to do something and being able to do something. And for me, like when I'm gone, when I'm no longer your assistant, I want you to be able to do them. Like you should know how to do things.
No, you just even if you don't line up another person. Let's be reasonable.
I know. Honestly, like you think after I'm done with – well, that's not a good way.
There are things that you can do now.
We're doing a podcast.
I thought you said we were getting married.
This is my 2 weeks notice.
Well, Chelsea, maybe at certain moments hard to blame him. But nonetheless, it sounds like he's arguing that he wanted you – I mean you're talking about somebody you hired to help you do a lot of stuff. Most people don't have that in their lives, right?
But no, most people don't have what all the things I have in my life.
Yeah, yeah. But so he still wants – he's like watching you and wants you to be able to equip yourself to kind of be able to manage as an autonomous person, it sounds like.
Yeah, he's got a lot of empathy. Empathy is something that I learned to cultivate. Empathy is something that I learned from Dan that I did not have. I had a lot of sympathy. I could show up for people when they needed me. I could throw money at a situation and say, hey, here's a stranger. Here's Puerto Rico. Here's my friend. And I would show up. I'm a great friend. I've always been I love showing up because my parents didn't show up. So it's my thing to show up. But I was showing up without thinking about how that person was really feeling or what that person was going through. I was showing up to be there to show that I could show up. And I think empathy and sympathy, the distinction between the two, you know, was something that I had to really have Dan reiterate to me so I had a better understanding of, oh, I'm so sympathetic, but I really lack empathy. And that was a huge door opener. because then I understood why I had such short patience for people that didn't do things the way that I did, or that couldn't, you know, pick up or weren't quick enough or pick up things as quickly as I could. Or I just was – I had a huge deficit of empathy. And now I have, you know, exercises I have to do if somebody annoys me, or if I'm at an airport or someone's like not getting it. I'm like, think about their life. Think about how many people they have to deal with a day. Think about what their home life must be like. Maybe they don't love their husband. Maybe they hate their wife. Who knows? Just start thinking about other people. Stop always thinking about yourself. And, you know, I had to really get my head out of my butt.
We have a call now from Guthrie, Oklahoma. Sally, thanks for calling in to talk with Chelsea Handler.
Ooh, what's Oklahoma. Your question?
Yes.
Hi. Yeah,
hi.
Growing up here my entire life, I don't get to have the beautiful liberal rest of the world with me. So how do you manage day to day, like you were just saying, what process do you have for other than just like saying, okay, empathy, for living in America today that is just, I mean, bombarded with Trumpisms and things like that. How do you just manage that, not kicking and screaming?
Well, I had to calm down and I had to learn. I went to Dan with the intention, ostensibly in the beginning, to learn how to talk to Trump supporters. That was what I wanted to do. I wanted to go on the road. I couldn't work on the show. I wanted to go on the road and get people elected. And I needed to learn to have dialogue with people that had opposing views from mine without my veins throbbing and popping out of my neck. You know, I wanted to learn how to make a point without screaming. And that's what Dan helped me with. He helped me with, you know, I meditate now. I mean, these are things that you would look at and be like, oh, God, meditation, please stop talking about it. I get it that it works, but it's not for me. Guess what? It is for me. Like, he taught me how to sit still, and he taught me how to come from a place of empathy to understand that everyone's viewpoint is different and people have had different experiences. It doesn't mean that I'm going to agree with them, but it means that I come from a much more loving place right now and I can understand how people get lost. Like, I lost hope in everything when Trump was elected. I thought, oh, this is the end of America, the end of an empire. And maybe that's what happens, you know, empires fall. And I didn't trust anyone. And now I believe in everyone. Everyone, even people who are doing bad things, they're just lost. They're not, everyone has goodness in them. I get that now. And it's so much easier to go through life feeling a connection towards people who are different from you than feeling the divisiveness. So it's a skill, like, you really have to take your time and take deep breaths and calm down and actually make a huge effort to be more patient, because it does work when you really apply yourself. And I was somebody who had none of it, and now I have it. So I'm a testament to it. Like, I always thought people who would, you know, even taking your time to respond to an email, I'm like, what? I mean, I've heard about people doing that, but I've never done it. I've already sent the email before I've even thought about what I wanted to say.
So you did these Netflix specials. I think it's the series Chelsea Does, right?
Yeah.
And that's where you were going to go talk to people who didn't agree with you. And you kind of had to realize that maybe haranguing them is not the way to do it. So that helped you. The empathy is going to help you, right? As I've learned with this job as well, to talk to people and to hear what they have to say. What did you learn if those Netflix specials were supposed to be about discovery and talking to people who didn't come at the world from your outlook? What did you learn from doing those specials?
I just learned how important it is to have uncomfortable conversations. I just shot another documentary for Netflix about white privilege. It's my own specifically, after I realized how much I was had
how Chelsea much white privilege.
Privilege, Chelsea privilege, yes, and white privilege. Uh-huh. Being a white pretty girl is it's a lot different than being being a minority in this country. And so anybody who doesn't think that's true isn't paying attention. And for me, you know, I shot this documentary and white people, you know, who doesn't want to talk about white privilege? White people. So once again, we're pinning it on people of color to figure out to tell white people what they're doing wrong without white people asking questions, because they don't want to be guilty of any sort of racism or prejudice. They don't want to have uncomfortable conversations. And, you know, I'm okay with uncomfortable conversations and I'm okay with saying the wrong thing. The only way to learn to become a better advocate or ally is by asking questions. So for me, it made me just redirect everything that I want to put out into the world. And like, you know, my book and this documentary are kind of coupled together because they were both post-election and they both are more of a reflection of what I'm going to do with the rest of my life. You know, I'm not going to sit and cash checks for myself. I'm going to make a contribution and stick my neck out and use my platform for good. And if people don't like that, then they don't like it. But the people who do, I'm strengthening my relationship with them, and they also want to activate and be, you know, be people who are sticking their necks out for marginalized communities. And right now, you know, if you're not using your voice, then you are part of the problem, is my opinion.
One last question along these lines. Let's say you were British. And so thanks to Brexit, right, you'd be surrounded in this, you know, atmosphere, this stew of what I'm sure you would find to be noxious nationalism, you know, all this, this anti-immigrant sentiment. But there was no Trump, just Brexit. Would that have driven you as nuts? Was it like the politics of the moment, or was it the personality of the moment that really did this to you?
That's a good question. I think it's all of it. I think it's really scary. You know, I think it's the fact that we have, you know, Russian interference, with that we probably have Saudi Arabian interference, and, you know, United Arab, like everything that's happening across the world. This isn't just us. Again, you know, that's America, you know, that isolationism. It's not us. It's the world. It's Europe and this kind of white nationalist tilt. It's all of what that, you know, I was naive. I was so spoiled in my life. I thought racism was, I thought it was a wrap on that. I thought sexism, I thought we were going to elect Hillary Clinton. I thought, oh, women and people of color, it's all, you know, we're all in this now. And so that was so naive for me to not understand until it really affected my life, and which, by the way, it hasn't, not in any material way, only emotionally. You know, well, actually, then it has. But, you know, for me to be that naive was like, oh, God, you don't know so much. And so I read as much as I could, Ta-Nehisi Coates and James Baldwin and William Chancellor's Destruction of Civilization and Rebecca Solnit. You know, even the Me Too movement was a shock to me. I didn't know how rampant sexual assault was because I had never been sexually assaulted. I didn't get it. I did not have an idea of what real people dealt with. And I needed to have a better understanding.
So then,
I don't think that answers the question you asked me, but anyway, it's
right.
Sort of.
You're saying it's the stew of the moment.
Stew of the moment. It's the unjustness of the moment. And it's, you know, for me, really, it's about Brexit's terrible. What's happening is terrible. You know, the president is a terrible person. And I just.
And you're
I don't
a very
want...
fortunate but enraged person by all that. So I do want to talk about this journey that you took as you tried to deal with that, because you spoke with your psychiatrist. You've allowed him to talk publicly about this. You kind of goaded him to do it. His name is Dr. Dan Siegel. You also discovered in this that this wasn't purely about President Trump, or at least that's what you and he concluded. And he kind of led you to talk about family issues. And listen, Lifetime gets viewers for a reason. Family issues often become very dominant in people's lives later in life, right? And you, it turned out, had not really processed the death of your brother when you were 9 years old and he was in his early 20s. How did you come to that realization? It seems like a very different point of a very different inspiration for such strong emotions.
Well, it was, I think what Dan explained to me, and he's on actually on my, this today's episode of my podcast, he's on it, talking about our therapy. So it was, what he explained to me was that, you know, the election of Donald Trump was destabilizing in my life. And the only other time that I felt destabilized because of how easy my life has been in terms of struggle. You know, I've never been hungry. I've never been assaulted. I've never been anything too traumatic. What did happen was my brother, you know, I was 9 years old. My brother was 22 and we had six children in our family. I was the youngest. He was the oldest. He was the captain of our little squad and I was the mascot and we were bookends. And that was my oldest brother was like, you know, my first crush, your first kind of boyfriend, your first example of love. Mm-hmm. And he was going on a hiking trip to the Grand Tetons in Wyoming with his best friend from high school and another guy. And he was telling me that he wasn't coming to our summer vacation with me and that he'd be back in 2 weeks. And he's like, you know, and I said, how can you not come to the vineyard? We went to the vineyard every summer since I'd been born, Martha's Vineyard. And he said, you know, he was graduated from college. And he said, sometimes people, you know, go away without their families. I'm like, what? Who? When? Anyway, he left and he said to me, you know, the night before he left, I made him a big bowl of cereal, which was our thing. I'd make him dinner when he got home from school really late. And he said, you know, I'll never leave you with these people. And then he left and he died.
And he didn't come back. And we'll pick this up after we do a very brief break. We are discussing the worldview and the life experiences, and the humor and the pain of Chelsea Handler with Chelsea Handler herself. You can join our conversation. What questions do you have her for her? What stand-up or comedic bits stick with you over the years? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, and we're talking today with the comedian and talk show host Chelsea Handler. Follow us on the Twitters and the Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me from NPR West in Culver City, California, is Chelsea Handler herself. Her new podcast, as well as her book, are called Life Will Be the Death of Me. And before we concluded the break that just passed, Chelsea Handler, we were talking a little bit about the death of your brother. He was in his early 20s. You were about 9 years old at the time. You had a big, boisterous family. I think there were six siblings, if that's right.
Yeah.
And
excuse me.
And he went hiking with friends in the Grand Tetons, and as you said, died and did not come back to you, which you saw as something of a betrayal and also something that you hadn't really dealt with. How did you process that as a kid, and what did that do to you?
Well, you know, you don't process it because you're nine. So I didn't process it. I heard it and I didn't like that news. And you watch everybody around you kind of fall apart. And in that moment, you do whatever you have to do to survive, whether you're 9 or 15 or, you know, 20-year-old has a better tools kit of, you know, the intellectual component versus the emotional component. Whereas a 9-year-old, what Dan explained to me was, oh, you didn't understand that it was an accident. You thought it was rejection, even though intellectually I know my brother went off and fell off a cliff. You know, emotionally, I was like, well, wait. He just told me he was going to be back in 2 weeks. And how could he go and let himself get killed? Like, why? How could he go and be so irresponsible? He just promised me that he would take me sailing. He just promised me. And in that moment, you take that as rejection. You know, he may as well have found another family or another little sister that was more fun and cuter and blonder or whatever criteria was necessary for me to, you know, make it okay to kind of steel myself up and become tough. And when I saw my father's reaction to my brother dying, which was really heart-wrenching, and my dad was this big, strong guy, and I saw him fall apart at the seams in front of our relatives, in front of our neighbors. You know, we're Jewish, so we were sitting Shiva. And it was really – I didn't like that. I looked at him, and I thought, oh, my God, Chet's dead, and now this guy is falling apart. Like, I'm going to lose everything. And all the adults are unreliable, so – I got to be tough and I got to not cry. And that was when I think I must have had this shift of self-preservation. And then I was like, okay, no crying. This is not going to be me. I'm going to get through this and I'll take care of this family if I have to. And that was my mentality. And that was the narrative that I just kind of married myself to for so many years. Like, I'm in charge. I'll take care of everybody. I'll never be vulnerable. I'll never cry. And then, you know, cut to me sitting here
I can hear the vulnerability, and yeah. I can hear the tears. You know, it's real.
Yeah. So you're just like, oh, whoopsie, because this has all been there for so long. And finally, when I met Dan, I was with somebody who could help me unearth it, and I could cry in front of. And now, you know, I'm doing that over and over again until I wring it out. And it's, and you know, and it's helped so much. Because I totally get me now. I get that I was just a little girl and I didn't have the tools to deal with it. I understand myself. I have compassion now for myself, which is integral in order to have compassion for anyone else in the world.
Dan Siegel, as you mentioned, your psychiatrist, here's what he had to say about how the young Chelsea processed Chet's death.
You also have autobiographical memory where things like the death of your brother will have a certain kind of meaning, the impact that happened then when you were 9, and all the ways in which that then goes back and has you change what your body's feeling, like an ache in your heart because of that incredible loss of Chet, right? So now you can't be aware of that as a 9-year-old. It's too much, especially because no one's supporting it. And so the comfort zone of I'm not going to feel my heart gets embedded in the way the head brain functions.
And so he's talking there about you know, I guess giving yourself leave to have some understanding of both your loss and of that it takes time and effort to kind of work through that. And I want to say to our listeners, we'll also put up some links and some resources for people if they themselves are going through similar kinds of loss and would like perhaps some materials or some folks who could give them guidance and how best to do that. I do want – we're getting a number of calls rolling in. I do want to take a few of them now. Let's take first a call from quickly from Boston, Massachusetts. Angela, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, David. Hi, Chelsea. I just read your book, Chelsea, well, on Audible, and you're hilarious. As always, I've watched your documentaries on Netflix. I love your pursuit of truth in yourself for others to be able to follow you. And post-election, this has been an insane ride for so many of us, and for you to voice it is just such a positive thing. I just want to say, after all this work you've done, please don't lose the root of what we came to know you as. Your quote-unquote meanness is exactly, or your directness, your straightforwardness, whatever you want to call it, is absolutely needed in the absence of everybody trying to be so politically correct all the time. We understand about empathy, and I'm glad you finally have grasped it too, but we need that truth that you've always displayed. And I just want to say you've done excellent work, and congratulations on this journey so far.
Thank you.
Thanks,
so
Angela.
Much.
Chelsea, what do you think? There's a vote there for meanness and saying don't let the empathy drown you out there.
No, I mean, I think she's saying to keep my directness, and I will always have that. I mean, listen, this is – I've always been honest. Always be honest. I mean, that's why I have – you know, the fans that I have is because they rely on me for my authenticity. That's my – I'm a communicator, so I will always be honest about what's going on, and I'll never lie, but there are ways to be honest that are helpful, and then there are ways to be honest that are just harmful. So it's just about finding that. And, you know, I think the response to this book is because everybody knows how authentic this is. You know, this isn't anyone – I've never put on a show. When I was drinking and partying, I was talking about that. When I was having one-night stands, I was talking about that. When I'm doing this, I'm talking about this. So mm-hmm. – At least people know that they're getting the truth. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I just have to say, I just heard my therapist and I had read all these comments that he sounds just like George Clooney and I had never made the connection. And now listening into it just now with you, I was like, oh God, he sounds exactly like George Clooney.
Basically, he's doing the cock of the head. He's doing the thing he did, you know, at the first season of ER where he looks and he says, are you okay with this? You doing
seriously,
right?
And I have a major crush on George Clooney, and I've never even gotten that until I read comments, and there were multiple saying, God, he sounds just like George Clooney. Funny.
Hilarious. We also have a call from Detroit, Michigan. Christina, go ahead. You're on the line with Chelsea Handler. Christina, we have lost you, so we're going to go instead to West Hartford, Connecticut. Pat is on the air. Pat, you're on the line with Chelsea Handler.
Hi, this is Pat. Yes, I was wondering, does having empathy make you a less edgy comic?
Thanks for the question. Chelsea Handler, what do you say?
Yeah, no, I don't think so. I think it makes you sharper in many ways. I don't have a problem with the funny. You know what I mean? I had a deficit with the serious. So I needed to balance those two things out.
Fascinating. You're basically saying I'm fine on that end of things. If I taper that a little bit, if I smooth out some of the edges, I'm still going to have plenty of edge.
Yeah. I'm very immature. So like that's just not going to go away very quickly. So that immaturity is where the comedy comes from and the self-deprecation and all of the nonsensical behavior. I'll never lose that because I'll always be a little kid. You know, I've had such arrested development. Even if I'm mature, I can't get that far.
You know, so Chelsea Handler, you draw on your own life, your actual life, a lot in your humor. Aspects of your life were chronicled in your series 2016 called Chelsea Does. In this scene, you're at a table with your late father, Seymour, and your siblings, and you're discussing your romantic relationship history.
Have you ever met anybody that you thought would be a good pairing for me?
No.
Wait, think about it.
Yeah, you need a very good sense of humor.
Have you liked any of the guys I dated ever? You met Curtis, right? Didn't
Did
you
meet
50
Curtis?
Cent?
Yeah, maybe
at
your
my
house?
Show.
50
did you,
Cent.
Did you meet him?
What'd you think?
Not much.
Oh.
What about Ted? Remember Ted? Remember I dated Ted?
Slightly.
Peter, remember British Peter? Did you like him?
Probably a little bit.
Chelsea Handler, did your dad have a point about your selections, about who you were
dating?
No,
my dad had no point about anything. He just – my dad is a lot like me and I'm a lot like him, or was. He passed away earlier this year, but he liked to have his opinion heard too, which is so the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. That's where I get it from. I'm a lot like him and loud, in your face, domineering, that kind of thing.
You made a point in the book about basically at times choosing people that you could find ways to reject, or choosing people that you might not have to reject, but finding ways to reject them nonetheless before anything got too invested. What were you doing there?
I was protecting myself. I was, you know, I thought I had this singledom, like, oh, I'm going to be single. I don't need, you know, I didn't know this whole I don't need a man, I don't need a man was, oh, I was rejected by a man when I was 9. You know, I didn't know that that was all strung together. So I thought, oh, I'm just so independent. I didn't want children. I didn't want to rely on any adult because all the adults were unreliable is what I came to find out. You know, by the time my parents did take me to therapy because I started to have so many problems and I was rebelling and I was so angry at my brother for dying. I'm so mad at him. And I started to have all these problems at school. So finally my parents like took me to a psychiatrist and I'd sit there with my arms crossed and be like, every adult who gives up on me is a win. Because I proved to myself again and again that they're unreliable. They don't care. They act like they do. But if anybody really cared, they wouldn't have let this happen, that kind of thing. So I'm sorry. Again, what was the question? I'm
That's
just like
right.
going off on tangents.
You answered the question quite directly. It was about your ability to push men off before somehow it made
yes,
you emotionally
Yes, so to
vulnerable.
Reject before they rejected me. You know, I tell a story in the book about having this boyfriend who lived down the Jersey Shore, and he was older than me, and we'd go every weekend, and on the ride home, I would shut down because we were separating, and I didn't have the vocabulary. I didn't know why I was shutting down, but I was like a little brat, and we'd drive 2 hours back, and he'd be like, what is your deal? Every Sunday night you get – because we wouldn't see each other for the full week until the next weekend. And I just wouldn't – I couldn't explain to him that I had separation issues, you know? So instead I would be mad, shut down, go and stomp in my room and be pissed all week long by being away from him and not having the vocabulary to express that. And eventually, you know, he broke up with me because it's really hard for an adult to date a 9-year-old little girl. And so it was all of those kinds of things, you know? It was very protective of myself and not being able to be vulnerable with anyone.
Mm-hmm. You know, Chelsea Handler, you obviously push the envelope with your comedy. There's this exchange in a scene from your 2016 series, Chelsea Does, in which you're kind of addressing the question of comfort and discomfort, and you're doing it in a way that raises discomfort, I think. It's a scene where you're interviewing the civil rights activist Al Sharpton for his opinion on where lines should be drawn, particularly pertaining to humor and to race.
What's acceptable for, like, a comedian? I'm a comedian. What am I allowed to say? What am I not allowed to say? Like, black people like fried chicken. Is that offensive to you, that black people like watermelon and fried chicken?
Yeah, I'm a vegetarian, and I don't like watermelon and fried chicken.
You can have watermelon as a vegetarian, FYI.
You can.
Yes.
But it's too much sugar in it for me.
Oh.
But I think you have to be able to laugh at yourself without making your culture the joke. And there's a fine line there. And I think that people ought to be sensitive to where that line is.
You know, Chelsea Handler, I got to say, far be it from me to ascribe wisdom to Reverend Al Sharpton, and yet I think he's making some really interesting points there, right? He's saying, first off, it seems to me he's saying, look, black people can do that. I'm not sure you can do that. But he's also saying, I think you have to find a way to laugh at yourself without making your culture the joke. Do you agree with that? Are you redefining, you know, the contours of where what's acceptable for Chelsea Handler as a result of what you've been going through?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, now I know, like, first of all, you can find humor in anything, so we don't have to make people feel bad. So that's a big lesson for me. You know, that was my brand of humor. You know, it's one thing to have an inside joke with a friend. It's another thing to have – you can't have an inside joke with somebody who doesn't know you. And you don't want people to leave feeling bad. So there are plenty of things to be laughing about. We just have to look around, and it makes us all a little bit sharper.
There's only a couple minutes left before we go, really just a minute and a half. But I did want to get to one question. It's interesting to me and striking to me that pretty much all the late night talk show hosts are men. You do have Samantha Bee over on TBS doing a satiric show. But you really were a singular figure. You know, I mentioned Joan Rivers as somebody who I heard echoes of in your comedy, but she also was an early talk show host. And then, you know, there wasn't one for a long time. What do you make of that absence even now, even in 2019, even after Me Too, even after all the promises of a better representation?
It's a grind. It's not like it's not a job, you know. I mean, first of all, we need more women, obviously, but it's not a job. You know, this isn't really your question, but I'm going to say it. It's not a job for everybody. It's, you know, it's a lot of it's a lot of fraudulence. From my experience, it was a lot of, you know, there's too many components of it for it to continue to remain important to me. There was too much nonsensical stuff that goes along with the talk show that felt silly and shallow after a while for me. You know, it felt like, and it was also, there was a sense of navel gazing and like, what was I really doing? And I think that maybe there's a reason why women are, you know, there aren't more women talk show hosts, because it is something that you really have to you have to be really driven to want that kind of life. It's a huge responsibility. You have all these people relying on you. And I don't know that, you know, that many people want that responsibility. You would think that they would, because it seems like a shiny, nice thing. But it's a lot.
And it's a lot. Forgive me. We're hearing there the words of Chelsea Handler. She is a comedian, a past late-night talk show host, currently a best-selling author, and now, dare I say it, a professional podcaster. Chelsea Handler, thank you for joining us for this hour today.
Thank you, David. Have a good day.
Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Me, I'm David Folkenflik. You've been listening to On Point.